Welcome to CUTV News Radio, where our hosts Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters talk to today's top thinkers from all around the world to bring you information, inspiration, and thought-provoking ideas that you can put to use in your personal or professional life right now. Covering a broad range of topics, we dig deep to discover what makes today's top thinkers tick. CUTV News Radio, it's the show where ideas matter. And now, here's today's host, Jim Masters.
And it's great to have you with us today as we broadcast live worldwide on CUTV News Radio, 2 p.m. Eastern here at the Broadcast Center. It's Tuesday, April 30th, 2019. We hope you're having a fantastic day. We're very excited to welcome Dr. David Fetterman of Fetterman & Associates, based in San Jose, California, to our show. You know, when educational or health initiatives are announced by within communities or companies, everyone cheers, but you never hear the story about whether it actually worked. You just hear the initial cheers. But did you actually accomplish the objectives? That's a very important question to be asked. And if it didn't work, how do you get it to work? These are questions that are generally answered by evaluation consultants who deliver reports and data visualizations based on meaningful data to reveal the source of a program's challenges and the basis for its successes, but without the collaborative engagement of program staff members, which is really important, corporate employees and or community stakeholders, it's very unlikely that these programs will ever succeed. That's where Dr. David Fetterman comes in. He's president of Fetterman & Associates, the international evaluation consulting firm. And I tell you, it's fascinating work that he does. He says usually when he's called in, the company, school, or hospital wants to enhance its performance, or the community needs help combating a serious health or educational problem. So he's also called in as well when there's some sort of disaster or things are falling apart. And while conventional evaluation traditionally assesses the effectiveness of an initiative externally and from the top down, Dr. Fetterman's empowerment evaluations turn everything upside down. The community is in charge their assessment within the context of what they are already being held accountable for. So Dr. Fetterman is a coach, facilitator, who helps keep things on track and rigorous. He says he teaches people how to assess their own programs. It could be in a township in South Africa or at Google in Silicon Valley. He's traveled across the globe from Australia and Japan to Spain and Brazil, helping people learn how to assess their own performance. Wherever it is, people are interested in improving their lives. And he shares the tools that help them accomplish their goals. It's peer-oriented. People, of course, learning from each other. They build their capacity to conduct evaluations. He helps ensure that rigor and accuracy. He says sustainability really is the gold standard. With over 25 years of experience at Stanford University in administration, the School of Education, and the medical school, as well as his administrative acumen running his firm, he has built a veritable arsenal of tools to help people accomplish their objectives and make their dreams a reality. That's what he helps people do, and then some. And it's my honor to welcome him to CUTV News Radio Live to learn about all of this and how he does it so well. And it's really incredible, the work that he does. And he's got a real passion and thirst and love for helping others achieve the things in life that they want to achieve and to be fulfilled doing so. Dr. Fetterman, thanks for joining us here on CUTV News Radio Live. It's a real honor and a pleasure to have you with us from live and direct from San Jose, California. And thanks for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Very excited about this topic and about the work that you do. And you have been really traveling all over. You just got back from South Africa, where you were collaborating with the UN. Tell us about that experience. That right off the top, I'm sure our audience is thinking, wow, that's really cool stuff. That must have been a fascinating experience. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've been to South Africa many times, and I give you some examples today on some of the work I've done, even in townships and squatter settlements. But the Mbeki African Leadership Institute at the University of South Africa invited us over there. It's as one of our United Nations system-wide evaluation mechanisms to teach about, well, the social justice principles guiding what we do and the degree of alignment that we have with their African Charter on Human and People's Rights. And we've taken the first steps already, but our plan is to do more training of South Africans and also train in Rwanda and other neighboring countries that are requesting our assistance. We'll be using it for learning and accountability, an interesting combination, while advancing the cause of human rights-based development agenda. So it's pretty cool stuff all the way around when you're combining people not need to know, did you do it? Accountability, but not just punitive, you know, accomplishments of, you know, punitive reactions to whether they've accomplished it, but actually, are you learning from it and developing and growing? The key for all of the things we're talking about today, you hit on it already, that sustainability is something that lasts well beyond my visit over there, my training, something that they can use for generations to self-assess and see where they're going and how to get there using evaluation feedback loops.
That's really, really important. You know, initially, when we step back a little bit in terms of what motivates and inspires people to do the work that they do and that you do so beautifully, what do you think in your own life's journey, Doctor, are some of the things that pointed you in the direction of doing this work and really pursuing it almost, you know, really as a calling for you?
Well, it's interesting. There's so many different things. Of course, you know, you think of your own family. And say my mom was a great role model. She's 91. She's still writing proposals and winning them. Very active. And she's actually even pursuing work to help bring different religions together in an ecumenical way because she's bringing back sort of a synagogue that I grew up in and making a historic site because it wasn't just that it was wonderful that a Jewish community was able to thrive in Connecticut, but it was mostly Holocaust survivors that came over there and found a home. And what was fascinating about it is that even people who are not Jewish donated their cattle, their calves, things of that nature, to raise money for the synagogue. So even in those days, it was very ecumenical, and she continues to do that to this day. And she also worked with low-income folks as well in different parts of Hartford and Connecticut. And things of that nature became sort of a model in my mind about doing the right thing, helping others in a socially progressive sort of fashion. And it kept on building and building. I started in an area of anthropology and ethnography and understanding people's perspective from their view of reality rather than just my own. And it just got to a point where I wanted to do more about assessing and using assessment and evaluation since it was so important for policy decision-making. But once again, from people's perspectives in the community or in the company, in the corporation, since I work in a wide variety of areas ranging, you know, from Google and Hewlett-Packard to, as they say, townships in South Africa, recovery cafes for homeless folks, et cetera, a whole variety of different places. But the same focus is to try to help them from where they are and move forward with their goals using, in this case, evaluation feedback loops on sort of where are you going and is this working? If it's not, let's have mid-course corrections and move forward. So a lot of the inspiration, I think, comes from my own family. And I've had the luck, good fortune of having very good mentors along the way who have been very generous about sharing their knowledge and their expertise. And all of them have been very low-key, comfortable, but extremely bright folks that I've been able to work with. So a great combination. So that's sort of the motivation, I think, that got me in the direction that I've been, you know, catapulted in. Sometimes not even out of your choice, you just evolve into these things. The key, I should mention, though, is that as you, I think, get older, you also want to leave something behind. I've been the president of the American Evaluation Association. I've won awards, all sort of thing, doing traditional kinds of evaluation. But at a certain point in your life, you want to leave something more valuable behind than the success of a nanosecond or something. And that's where you leave basically an approach that helps them help themselves. So you're building towards, as I say, that sustainability that you mentioned earlier.
Which is important. Very, very important. Tell us about the other thing that's important, which are these empowerment evaluations. Tell us first, what is an empowerment evaluation? How do you define it, doctor? And then what are some of the steps of the empowerment evaluation?
Yeah, in the largest sense, empowerment evaluation is really a gateway to growth in human potential, capacity, and self-determination. It helps people think differently. They think in terms of the capacity that they have for change, and it contributes to self-sufficiency, self-efficacy, and the importance, of course, as we just mentioned, being of service to others. The bottom line is it's really traditional evaluation approaches, tools that you use and concepts to assess whether you're getting to where you want to go and whether you're getting results. But as you mentioned earlier, it's the same concept, except you turn it upside down so that the people you're working with are in charge of their goals and their strategies within the context of what they're already being held accountable for. And you, instead of being the expert who knows everything, you're the coach or critical friend who helps keep it rigorous, keeps things on track, and provides evaluation expertise. But they guide where it's going. So that's core of what empowerment evaluation is about. As I mentioned, I think earlier, we work in 16 different countries, from Australia to Israel, Japan to South Africa. We've worked with Google, Hewlett Packard. We work on Native American reservations, Stanford University School of Medicine, helping them get through accreditation. You name it. We've been involved in all sorts of different kinds of activities. And I should say this, what's fascinating about the process is that it's been adapted in all these different places, points to, in a sense, how similar we really are underneath in terms of how we are all desiring to improve life for ourselves, for our children, and for our communities, wherever you go. And that's why I think it's been very successful around the world. And it's also focused on not just a wonderful process that we can talk about today, but did you do it? The outcomes, did you actually reach the results? And that's a lot of what empowerment evaluation is about, helping people get to where they want to go.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You really incredible work that you've done with folks with Hewlett Packard. You facilitated an empowerment evaluation of a $15 million Hewlett Packard Digital Village Initiative. Tell us a little bit about what that was like and what it entailed.
Yeah, I have a whole book on it for those interested by Stanford Press called Empowerment Evaluation in the Digital Villages, Hewlett Packard's $50 million Race Towards Social Justice. It was really an honor to be involved in it. What we did is we helped three different groups, basically, and this was when Carly was the head of Hewlett Packard. And we had basically one group was about 18 or 19 tribes in San Diego. That was the Tribal Digital Village. And then we had another major initiative in East Palo Alto in California. And then we also had one in Baltimore. The one for the Tribal Digital Village was probably the most successful. And according to the former head of the FCC, they built one of the largest unlicensed wireless systems in the country. And keep in mind, they could care less about computers when we first started about this, but the concept behind all of that project was to bridge the digital divide in communities of color, in this case for Native Americans. They also built a printing press, a digital printing press, very successfully. And they also started small businesses separate from that. It was phenomenally successful. The kids learned how to repair the routers, so that when we left and the money disappeared, they'd know how to maintain these systems. It was fantastic in terms of an alternative to gambling, gaming, casinos that some tribes were very successful in, others didn't have a part of, but it gave folks an alternative for self-sufficiency, economic sufficiency, and self-determination. So that one was phenomenal. That one is interesting. We received a tremendous amount of press also. We had tons of radio interviews and calls and newspaper. People were very interested. And I never know why, whether it was the empowerment, the digital aspect, the $15 million, you were talking, I don't know what part of it caught everyone's attention, but I was on all these radio interviews and news interviews for almost a year after it was even published. So that was very powerful, very successful. But, you know, we've done other projects as well where we've really surprised people about how powerful the outcomes have been. Like in Arkansas, we work at tobacco prevention, keeping minority kids away from tobacco. And we were relatively successful for a while, getting large numbers of kids away from tobacco. And but the way politics work is that there are folks that were going through the presidential campaign at the time. I remember that one. They want to steal the money, and that's how it works in social service and politics and stuff, steal the money from tobacco prevention to put into drug courts. Now, the difference is, luckily, we had data. We documented how many kids we were keeping from smoking and getting them to stop as well. And using CDC and Arkansas Department of Health data, translated that into money, because people want to know ROI, the return on investment. And we were able to document that we were saving the state over $9 million in excess medical costs through this effort, this initiative. So people want to know, does empowerment evaluation produce outcomes? Yeah, even traditional return on investment outcomes are evidenced. And what was really remarkable about that is I testify a fair amount in different legislatures, and usually folks are just talking and talking, and they've already made a lot of their decisions. But this time when I was presenting and showing how much money was saved, you could hear a pin drop. It was incredible. So, but that's because they knew also it was in their vested interest to hear this news, because it would make them look good as well by protecting the money that they had secured for this effort, showed it was a good investment. So a lot of this, as we're talking about this today, is very, humanitarian, positive, social justice, but it's also converging self-interest. When these things all combine to be of interest to different parties, they'll come together and unite to work on projects that they otherwise would be divided and not as interested in. Let me just briefly mention, if I could, an example in East Palo Alto. Everyone said, David, you're going to fail in there, because you've got Pacific Islanders, African Americans, Latinos, and they don't get along with each other. How are you going to get any kind of consensus or anything? I just said, we had started facilitating a session with everyone, and I said, how many of us want to have better schools for our kids? Hands went up all across. Didn't matter what your background was, ethnic background. Same thing for security, because it was not a particularly secure, safe situation. Hands went up. Couldn't agree on housing? Fine. Then we didn't deal with housing at that point. But the point of it was that it may sound, and is to some degree, very positive and socially responsible and progressive, but really it's converging self-interest, where we found a common denominator that we could all work on. And that's what we moved forward with, using this process of identifying goals and assessing them, monitoring them, making mid-course corrections, that sort of thing. So we've been very successful in a number of areas. One, of course, you just mentioned the Hewlett-Packard $50 million project. In Arkansas, we've been very successful, not just in tobacco prevention, but we've also worked in the schools. And we've actually helped to raise student test scores and increase learning. It's been phenomenal working with Dr. Cherry Smith over there for that particular project. For the tobacco one, I work with one of my colleagues, Linda Delaney. And we've been very successful in some of the toughest areas in the Delta. If you're familiar with the area, there's mm-hmm. there are very few companies over there, and there's all you see is cotton fields and rice fields and soy fields, just nothing. I mean, the funny thing that happened is they sent me a lot of these records, the attendance records for the schools when I was in my office at Stanford. And I've been working in education for many, many decades, never mind years. And they had very high attendance and low truancy, and that made low scores, like in the 25th percentile. And I've been working there a long time in this area, but mostly in urban areas, and it makes no sense to me. Because if kids are basically operating at the 25th percentile, scoring low, being told you're a failure, they don't attend. They're truant. These kids are doing the opposite. They were 90% attendance. So I took I grabbed my jacket and got on a plane and went off to Little Rock, and then I drove down to some of these Delta schools. And guess what? As I say, you saw cotton fields and soy fields and cotton fields and just on and on. So, of course, when you finally got to these tiny little towns in the Delta, of course there was high attendance because there was nothing else to do. So it was a riot.
Mm-hmm.
They actually made sense, the high attendance in this case, when normally it wouldn't, because normally kids would be truant. But we were able to improve test scores, improve the educational process. So we've had many different accomplishments. And let me mention one more if I could, not just mine. I've had many of my projects, but I have folks, sort of colleagues of mine that were Fulbright scholars that worked with me. They help Peruvian women use empowerment evaluation to build small businesses with their crafts, making them a little more professional, selling them on the internet to bypass the middle person who used to take a lot of their profits away. It's incredible. And I've had, Castro Moreno and Diaz Puente. I've had folks work, by the way, with kids. Langhout and Fernandez, they work with fourth and fifth graders to use empowerment evaluation to make schools more inclusive. And Margaret Dugan works to help change youth sexual behavior to reduce unplanned pregnancy and HIV and AIDS transmission rates. So we have a phenomenal number of projects, not just me. Abe Wandersman, a colleague who worked with me for many years, doing substance abuse prevention. Just to give you an idea of the scope of how,
incredible.
How widely this is used.
Well,
it's been impressive.
I mean, you even work in Arkansas on tobacco prevention. I mean, that's amazing, and that's so helpful. Tell us a little bit about what that's like.
Well, that one is very, you know, people don't realize it's not the sexiest topic for some people because it's tobacco, but tobacco
it's important.
Is the single most, it's the single most preventable cause of disease, disability, and death in the United States. You know, it's responsible for more than 400,000 Americans each year, the death of 400,000. And that's more than AIDS, alcohol, car accidents, illegal drugs, murders, and suicides combined. People have no idea. It's just that it seems like it's been under control or not as sexy as, say, obesity or other kinds of concerns or the opioid epidemic.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all critical. But people forget that there's this underlying one that's been very powerful in the United States and unfortunately extremely successfully exploited. With minority communities, what we are helping to turn around without question.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. It's incredible work. I also understand you were recently recognized as the top anthropologist of the year in 2019. So, it appears your work in ethnography and ethnographic evaluation is obviously well-recognized. Tell us what that actually entails and why it's so important. And of course, congratulations on the recognition too.
Well, thanks. No, I appreciate it. I appreciate the honor of getting it. That was a bit of a surprise, but you know, nice to have these surprises every so often in your life. But that one, it was interesting because it's also a way of, I think, an opportunity for me to be able to highlight the value of ethnography to folks. Ethnographers do work in places like Intel, look at corporate culture, land management, indigenous affairs, a whole bunch of different things. It's really an approach that, in my case, preceded my work in empowerment evaluation, but I worked together with it. And it's funny, by the way, people think, what is ethnography? It's just a method in anthropology for describing different cultures, both in the United States and outside. But the key aspect of ethnography versus just, say, journalism, or distinguishes it from journalism, is that you're trying always to get the emic or insider's perspective of reality. So it's very similar to journalism, but it's a little bit different in that regard. And you spend a long time with people, so you get to see them in their natural behavior. Instead of their company manners, that drops aside.
Yeah.
You get to see how they operate on a routine basis, that sort of thing. And you can use this approach in schools, listening to people, companies, communities, rather than in a laboratory experiment. And you can sort of probably already guess, I started a lot with ethnography and understanding people from their perspective first, and then evolved into empowerment evaluation. Let me give you an example of how powerful ethnography can be to help people and save lives, literally, as well. One of my first projects that I had in medical anthropology was we were looking at folks that were dying in sort of the New England area up to New York, et cetera, basically the Northeast, and mostly Cubans and Puerto Ricans that were dying and some African Americans at a disproportionate rate. Well, they'd already consulted physicians and epidemiologists and others, and no one could seem to figure out why this is happening. So they asked us to come on over as ethnographers and anthropologists, and we hung out with folks. We asked them, you know, what do they do? How do they take care of their medicating habits? And we got to be, you know, built a trust and had a very good relationship with a lot of folks, and they brought us sort of into their lives. Well, bottom line, make it very short and quick, is we found that they were seeing spiritistas or kind of what we call, you know, witch doctors or herbalists, whatever term, you know, you want to use. And they were providing herbs for their various ailments. One very important one was foxglove. Well, foxglove in a synthetic form is digitalis, and that is to regulate your heart. So they were sometimes embarrassed to tell their physician that they were taking these herbs, and often the physician didn't even want to hear about the herbs. They just poo-pooed them as something that's not significant or medically important.
Yeah.
So between the two parties, what was happening? Double dosing, and that's, of course, death. So we were able to sort of figure out what was going on and share, because we listened from the emic or insider's perspective of reality, what was going on. And then what we did is we didn't make a judgment about that's being good or bad. We just brought it to light so all the parties knew, and knew then the physicians knew to ask about these kinds of things, and people in the community felt more empowered to be able to talk about these medications that they're taking. And we even got the faith healers to talk with the physicians. So we sort of opened up the lines of communication. And this whole process, as you can already see, rests on something that I think a lot of folks don't sort of appreciate, and that's the concept of multiple realities. And people usually go, what do you mean by that? You know, Dr. Fetterman, multiple realities, isn't there a one reality? Well, briefly, let me give you a quick example. Isn't there just an objective reality then that's all you live by? Not, especially as a scientist, right? Not exactly. If an example where I worked in a VA hospital, a psychiatric ward, helping folks in that area, there are people, men particularly, who think they can fly. I mean, like, I don't mean like on the plane. I mean like fly. Now, you may not believe they can do that, and I may not believe that's possible, but there are real-world physical consequences for that perception of reality if they're on the fourth floor of a building with windows with no bars on it. So it highlights how the perception of reality, the insider, the emic perception of reality, is just as important as the objective Durkheimian factual reality, you know, that we call a table or a chair or a computer, et cetera. And I think a lot of that work that I've done in ethnography is what helped prep me for making the transition into creating a form of evaluation that's more person-focused, more the insider perspective of reality than always the outside expert. I luckily for my training, I had an appreciation for understanding the other's perspective, the insider's perspective, rather than assuming that we know it all. And that helped me make the transition, I think, to changing evaluation.
See, that's really important. You know, Doctor, I can't believe that our time has completely disappeared.
Amazing.
I mean, there's so much more to talk about. You're a classical pianist. You've become a jazz pianist, and you've just done so much work. We'll definitely have to explore more, because the work you're doing is extraordinary. I think it's impactful, vital. I think it's something that many people should realize and understand and appreciate. And I think it's incredible. And obviously, you're very astute and love sharing it with us. And I appreciate that. I want folks to be able to go to the website, www.dr, and that's D-R, drdavidfetterman.com. And that's F-E-T-T-E-R-M-A-N, drdavidfetterman.com, to learn more about the incredible work that Dr. David Fetterman at Fetterman Associates is doing. He is the president of Fetterman and Associates, which again is an international evaluation consultation firm based in San Jose, California. Dr. Fetterman, thanks for joining us on the show. This half hour really flew by, as I teased earlier when we were chatting before we went live on the air. We just fly by, get into a really good rhythm and conversation as we have. But hopefully we'll chat some more and explore more and expound a little bit more. But for now, this was a real pleasure and thoroughly enjoyed it. Hope you did as well.
Yeah, thank you. It really was a pleasure. And you're right. It went by just like that. Blink of an eye.
Yeah. In the blink of an eye in a New York minute. You have a wonderful rest of your day, and I'm sure we will chat again soon. We have those New England connections as well, which is wonderful. Again, folks, go to the website, drdavidfetterman.com. Learn more. He's a fascinating individual, and he loves sharing his knowledge and wisdom and perspective. And again, he works on incredible projects locally, regionally, nationally, and worldwide. This is Jim Masters thanking you for your time this time. Till next time, stay tuned. More great episodes of CUTV News Radio Live are coming right up in just a moment. Till then, for the entire team, everybody here, we thank you for being with us worldwide on CUTV News Radio Live, and we wish you a spectacular day. Thanks for being with us. Bye for now.
You've been listening to CUTV News Radio. If you want to learn more about our programming or perhaps be considered for a future show, visit us on the web at www.cutvnews.com. And if you enjoyed listening to today's show, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and be sure to write a review. Thanks for listening, and from all of us at CUTV News Radio, we hope you have a productive and inspired day.